safety officer who ran provides a safety contact and reporting after a weekend blizzard and a couple days of thinking out.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Goldman. First of all, I want to talk about if there is an emergency or a fire alarm, please exit through the door that you came in or through the either door to my right at the head of the room. We will go across 5th Street to the building museum, and please collect over there. Make sure you use a walkway and don't cross jaywalk in the process. Also, in the event it's needed, there's an AED that's out by the guard guard station by the elevators. Appropriate that you're talking about the winter storm. That's actually what my safety contact for this morning is dealing with. The subject is employee injuries. So this past winter storm resulted in 3 OSHA recordable injuries, which is the second lowest experience of the past 4 snowstorms that exceeded 10 inches. So this storm, we had 3 recordable injuries. The lowest actually was in February of 2010. We had 2 injuries with 17.8 inches of snow. December 2009, we had 9 injuries in a snowstorm then, and another snowstorm in February of 2010, we had 7 injuries. So we're certainly moving in the right direction. We would like to get that to zero. We did a good job in protecting against typical injuries associated with snowy and icy conditions, the slips, trips, and falls, the road accidents, but we did see multiple hand injuries, one of which resulted in a severed fingertip. As we will discuss next month, the number of employee injuries related to hand safety increased last year, along with current leading indicators demonstrating that employees' focus on hand safety may be waning a bit, with more safety observations relating to improved hand tool use, lack of hand-related protective equipment. The following points are important to keep in mind not only when using power equipment to remove snow, but also when hazards are present when working with your hands. Top reasons for hand injuries: not thinking about where we place our hands and not paying attention at the job, to the job at hand, taking shortcuts and intentionally disregarding safety procedures and safe work practices, not using proper tool for the job, not using appropriate personal protective equipment, lack of training of awareness of hazards that are present. Safety tips for using snow throwers, and that's where the injury occurred for the employee. Always keep hands and feet away from all moving parts. Utilize high-visibility gloves to better visualize hand placement. Stop the engine before attempting to clear the snow and debris from any part of the snow thrower. Use chute clean-out tool or a long stick to unclog wet snow. Never leave the machine running in an enclosed area. Add fuel to the tank outdoors before starting the machine. And if you have electric-powered snow thrower, be aware of where the power cord is at all times. That concludes my safety contact.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Two matters of committee business before we move on to the informational part of the presentation. The agenda, I assume everyone's had a chance to review the agenda for today's meeting. If so, I'll take a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. And approval of the minutes from the December 17th, 2015 meeting. If you've all had an opportunity to review those, I'll entertain a motion for approval of those minutes. Thank you, Mr. Giancola.
Second?
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion. The minutes of December 17, 2015 are adopted. Good morning again. Before I give you a preview of today's agenda, I'd like to first recognize and thank the Metro employees, led by General Manager Paul Wiedefeld, who worked tirelessly through the weekend and the days following the blizzard to restore service for our region. Thanks to their efforts, Metro was able to safely restore limited bus and rail service on Monday, an additional Metro bus, Metro rail, and Metro access service throughout the rest of the week through today, Thursday. The decision to shut down the system over the weekend was the right one, I'm convinced. Just as importantly, Metro employees worked thousands of hours over the past weekend, and they worked it safely, as Mr. Brown reported. Thanks to the General Manager and all of our employees for a job well done. Thank you, General. Thank you all. Now, on to the agenda. Our first item is the 2015 security report. Chief Pavlik will provide the committee with an overview of Part 1 crimes in the Metro system. While crimes are up 5% from CY 2014, a matter of some concern to this committee, they remain near all-time lows and are below the targeted Metropolitan Transit Police Department targets for 2015. Following the chief's presentation, and assuming the whole panel arrives, we have two-thirds of it. At this point, we will hear another of our periodic updates from our regional emergency response partners, Chief Mark Bashur of Prince George's County Fire Department, and the chair of the COGS Fire Chiefs Committee, Steve Souter, Fairfax County Director of Public Safety Communication, and chair of the COG 911 Committee, and COG's Deputy Executive Director, Stuart Friedberg, who I understand is en route. Following that, our Chief Safety Officer, Lou Brown, will update the committee on Metro's progress in responding to the FTA Safety Management Inspection Corrective Action and the ongoing work to improve Metro's safety culture. This presentation will also provide information on the transition of Metro oversight from the TOC to the FTA. And our final item this morning, Assistant General Manager Andy Off, will give us an update and an explanation of the uncoupling incident on the Green Line that happened earlier this month. So I'd now like to turn the floor over to Chief Pavlik to begin the agenda and the 2014 safety report.
Good morning, Mr. Goldman and members of the board. As you stated, we're here to review the 2015 crime statistics. When you open this first slide, is one thing I want to draw the attention to. As it shows here, we're in almost 15% our KPI. And when you look at the crime trend, as you stated, crime is slightly up this year on the rail side. Crime has continued to trend in a positive direction. And basically, with that being said, you know, we use a CompStat model of policing where we send our resources and how we allocate our resources. Another notable issue is arrests are up over 5% this year. Our enforcement efforts as far as criminal and civil citations are up over 20%, and our fare evasion enforcement is up over by 30%. When you break down our modes, we look at three modes statistically, the first being bus. Bus is relatively flat when you compare it from 2014 to 2015. When you look at 2014, the average is 1.8 per million riders. In 2015, it went down slightly, and now it's 1.03. So not a big difference in crime. Some of the increases we have seen, which is not a Part 1 offense, is assaults against our bus operators. Last year, we had 83 bus operators that were assaulted, slightly increased from 2014, where we had 78. Although it's not a Part 1 offense, it's something we pay great attention to anytime one of our employees is assaulted. And when you look at the root cause of those assaults, 62% of them are caused by fare evasion or a verbal fare dispute or a verbal issue. When you look at the rail side, that's where we saw our biggest increase, and most of that is attributed to the theft of cell phones and robberies. And we'll talk about that in greater detail later. And then the parking lot crime. Parking lot crime has its up and downs. Late this year in August, we had a little rash of an increase of theft where individuals were breaking into vehicles to steal handicapped placards. That went on for about 3 weeks or so before we apprehended the two individuals, and we haven't had any since. So when you look at our Part 1 crime against property, those numbers speak for themselves. Again, theft snatch remained relatively flat, a slight decrease. Pickpockets we saw our greatest increase, most of them occurring on board trains. The theft from the autos was the handicapped placards, and then the bicycle remained a little flat. So when you look overall, the crime is going up and down. But again, robberies continues to be our biggest one, and you'll see that in the next slide, where our property crime is relatively flat overall. Here's where we saw our biggest increases and of concern. Robbery force and violence is one that jumps out at you right away. And most of those robberies are increasing at the bus stops. We saw drastic increases at bus stops. And one of the challenges there is, you know, was this person, in fact, waiting for a Metro bus, or were they, in fact, just sitting there at a bus stop? There's always questions about jurisdiction and things of that nature, but at the bottom line is if there's a victim of a robbery at a bus stop, then the transit police are going to step up and do what's required. When you look at where the robbery is occurring, our biggest increase we saw at LaFont Plaza. That's for a variety of reasons. Transfer station, so sometimes a crime is captured at LaFont Plaza, but it might actually captured the incident occurred on a train and reported at LaFont. So one thing we're trying to do in 2016 is really drill down with our officers and get more data as to how we can highlight that crime. We're going to a new records management system here in the spring, and hopefully in 2016, that will give us the ability to drill down more on where the crime is actually occurring, where right now you'd have to pull every offense report to figure out where that crime is. Again, the bus stop crime is something of concern. We saw about a 70% increase there, and those are crimes committed actually at bus stops. you know, which is over 12,000 between the National Capital Region, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. The homicides, you know, with the little asterisk there, we did have two homicides in 2015, one occurring on July 4th at the NOMA station and the other one 2 weeks later at the Wheaton Garage. Both those homicides were closed with arrest within days of them occurring. And one thing that has come up with that is, you know, how the homicides are recorded. The Metro Transit Police is a FBI reporting agency, which means the FBI has given us the authority to report crime to them. Most municipalities or small police departments don't have that authority. They report their crime to the local jurisdiction. However, Transit Police is recognized as a police agency by the FBI. However, the only difference is for homicides. So that's why that little asterisk is there, is the local jurisdictions have to report our homicides. That is the only crime that they report, and it's because of the FBI rules and the way that's classified. So NOMA, again, it was thanks to our CCTV, and the same thing at Wheaton, where within minutes of those crimes occurring, we were able to get still images of those individuals, identify them. The Wheaton arrest occurred within moments after the shooting, and then the NOMA bid, that arrest occurred several days later. We look at our sexual harassment complaints. That's something that we've started back in 2012 through the web portal. This is still a great initiative, and a lot of outreach is still going on. We saw a little increase from 2014 to 2015 by about five offenses, and criminal, non-criminal, and harassment. So the way we break those down is if it's a criminal assault, criminal non-sexual harassment, criminal sexual in nature, if the individual committed an act that is a sexual in nature, non-sexual would be more of your simple assaults, maybe a shove, a push, expectorate on, things of that nature. And harassment is just individuals who are trying to get a young lady's phone number or verbally harasses individuals. So we're not seeing big increases there. The bus is where we've seen a slight increase of it reporting, and we're continuing to monitor that. The web portal is very successful. We continue to partner with Safe Spaces. So that's going very well, and hopefully that continues. That concludes my report, Mr. Goldman. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Chief. let me just start off with a question, because I do think that the rise, spike in crime against persons is of concern, even though overall crime is down. The question would be this increase in robberies and aggravated assaults. What's the cause of it? Where do you think that's coming from? And what proactive steps are you taking in the force taking to try and give riders a greater level of comfort that the system is safe?
Yeah, so late last year in December and then early this year, we had four very high-profile cases, whether it was the NOMA incident, which was closed with an arrest, or the Green Line incident closed with arrest. They've gotten a lot of attention, justifiably so, because of the nature of the attack. They've been very brazen. You know, one thing I would echo and thank this board really for is the resources, because our CCTV system is paying off in huge volumes. Now that we've stood up our Security Operation Control Center out in Landover, Maryland, and dedicated those resources, we're making headway through our CCTV, and it's working to our advantage. The other thing we're doing is, I spoke of earlier, is the CompStat model policing. You know, we really believe in that. You know, we have a finite number of resources, and through trending and you know, looking at data real time, is dedicating those resources, the partnerships we've had with MPD. When you look at our Part 1 crime, you know, over 55% of our Part 1 crime is occurring in the District of Columbia. So the relationship I have with MPD and our agency has with MPD is near and dear to us. We have a daily conference call at 1 o'clock every day to talk about crime, especially where it's going, what they're trending, what they're seeing in the city, and when you compare it to us. When you look at overall crime, you know, it's 6 per million riders. When you look at the National Capital Region, it's over 20 per 1,000 riders or 1,000 citizens. So we're doing very well, and, you know, the media plays a great role in that in helping get the word out and making our customers aware. And Dan and his group through social media does it very well. So the key is, deploying our resources based on the CompStat model. The CCTV, I can't say enough about, and the partnership we have with MPD is just going great.
At this point, do you see a need for any additional resources, either personnel or technology?
No, I think, I have the resources there. I have a vacancy rate I'm dealing with, about 10% right now, filling those vacancies and continuing that partnership. MPD, we know, and I spoke about at the mayor's press conference a couple of weeks ago, their criminals are our criminals and vice versa. That partnership is real. And one thing MPD and Chief Lanier did was she dedicated an officer to our command center now. So we have an officer that sits there every day and monitors our CCTV with us, sharing radio transmissions. So the future is, you know, CAD-to-CAD sharing, where computer-aided dispatching and MPD can see our CAD and we can see their CAD. It's really the intelligence sharing that's really making the headway in the region and reducing the crime overall.
Thank you. Mr. Giancola, and then Mr. Corcoran.
Yeah, thank you for the report, Chief. Just a quick question on slide 9 on bus stop robberies increased. Do we have a sense, and I know we as far as rail incidents, we have the location on the rail, but do we have some breakdown of the jurisdictions of where the robberies are occurring, and are they in more populated areas versus more rural parts of our system? So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so most of, like I said, most of our Part 1 crime, 55% of it's here in the District of Columbia, followed by about 26% Prince George's County. And when you look geographically where that's occurring, most of it is in Ward 7, Ward 8. Anacostia Station continues to be a challenge for us, Congress Heights, Southeast D.C., and then right there on the border of Prince George's County. So a lot of our resources there. When you look at Virginia, you know, they only account for 3% of our Part 1 crimes. And then when you drill down and say, well, what are those crimes? Most of those are stolen bicycles. A lot of property crime, not so much robbery, force, and violence.
So the bus stop increases are at actually the bus stops at the metro stations, is what you're saying?
No, bus stops, say, along Martin Luther King Avenue,
along
8th Street corridor. So these are high transfer stations traditionally, you know, Alabama Avenue, Southern Avenue.
And I assume you've increased your patrols in those areas as well.
We have. So what we're doing is it goes kind of a double-edged sword there. We saw the slight increase with the bus operator assaults, and we know 60% of that's driven by fare evasion and verbal disputes. So, and you look at those routes, and you look at where they're occurring, and then, again, the crime. So we're putting a lot of resources in those areas, whether it's uniformed police officers or plainclothes.
Thank you. Chief, thank you for the report. To put it in perspective, when you look at these numbers and we've seen some increases in certain areas, how does that compare to the overall jurisdiction? Is D.C., is Virginia, is Maryland, or are the individual jurisdictions seeing similar percentage increases, or are we standing out with the increases that we're seeing?
You know, the annual COG report will come out hopefully by March or April. That really tells a story for the region. And it's challenging to speak for other jurisdictions. I know some of the same areas we've been challenged with, like Ward 7, Ward 8, Anacostia, MPD has been challenged with that same PSA. They call them public service areas. We call them metro service areas. But some of those same increases we're seeing, the jurisdiction are seeing, and in some cases at a higher level than we are.
Okay. So it could be thought of as societal as compared to a metro issue, although it's always going to be our issue to manage.
Correct.
Is that fair? And secondly, with the another question, the 1,900 target events, I'll call them, is it time to lower that to 1,500? Since we're while we've done a great job against that, is it time to move that down?
We are. So the 2016 goal is we always look to set our KPIs, and working with Ms. Bernstein, the Office of Performance, we will have a lower number. Our goal is to always bring it down anywhere from 2 to 5% every year. At some point, it will flatten out. You know, what that number is, I'm not sure. When you look at 2014, we had a 27% decrease in Part 1 offenses. 2014 was a great year for us. Though it's a slight increase this year, when you look at the slide there, going back 7 or 8 years, really tells a story. So we're on the right track. Again, it's through the deployment of our resources, using technology, the awareness campaigns, reaching out to, you know, our riders and keep our riders informed. But, yeah, obviously we will reduce that KPI from 19 to a lower number for 2016, yes.
All right. I'd like to thank you for a job well done.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, any other questions? Ladies? Chief, one more question. In the past, on the increase in robberies and the aggravated assault, you've at least expressed the view that a lot of this was because of, I guess, smartphones and other electronic devices that people are using in the trains and the buses. Do you have some advice to riders as to how to better deal with those situations to try and discourage that kind of crime by the riders?
Yeah, I think as a society, we're all so cell phone dependent anymore, and it's more than a cell phone. So, you know, there's this misnomer out there that they're going to steal your phone and reactivate. They're not. You know, that's still a gaming device, a video device, music device, you name it. And then you got career criminals who might use it for other, you know, nefarious acts, for banking needs, whatever the case may be. But the biggest thing is, you know, good common sense. You know, don't use it on the system if you don't have to. Bottom line, keep it out of sight. If you're going to use it, use two hands. Maintain your situational awareness. One thing we're seeing with the robberies, it's usually two or three individuals. They surround a person. One person snatches it, and the rest run or try to be a decoy. They pass it on. So really good street advice, whether you're in a metro system or on a street corner, a restaurant, or a local mall. You know, just use good common sense, you know, two hands at all times, you know, would save it, not using it at all, and then keep your head on a swivel, you know, pay attention to your surroundings.
Thank you, Chief. Good advice. Thank you. All right. We'll move on. Gentlemen, Chief Bashir, Mr. Friedberg, made it. Mr. Satter, I guess we'll start with Chief. Chief has made as much FaceTime in the last couple of days on TV as Mr. Riedefeld, so we're all recognize you by now.
Oh, joy. So does the lady at McDonald's at MIT. I appreciate the opportunity. It has been a busy time for all of us. As we introduce the presentation, I think it's important to note right from the beginning that the Fire EMS in WMATA has, over the course of the past year, forged much more of a public safety fabric than occurred in the past. It's just reality. We have a lot of progress that's been made, and we recognize there's a lot left to do. So we just wanted to give you that update, and we appreciate the opportunity, and we're going to cover the things you see there, everything from the training, the ROC liaison, the leadership the meetings that we're having, and then the communication study. So if we go on to the training, you know, we have indeed, I'm not going to read the slide, but we have indeed developed a comprehensive training program and manual that has been updated twice since. Several of the incidents that the ROC liaison and other incidents that are provided to us, several of those incidents have driven changes to the training. So things that we have observed because of the ROC liaison have driven some of our changes in training. Things that we've observed with Chief Pavlik and the safety group also have driven changes as we've implemented those training programs. We've seen where things needed to be a little bit different. The passenger rail subcommittee is currently working on a report, a comprehensive report of the entire region's firefighters, which, again, numbers close to 10,000 firefighters in a region, of how those folks have all gotten into the system. All 10,000 have not gotten into the training. That it just has not happened yet. Eventually, we'll get there. But that subcommittee, is part of our COG subcommittee, is in the process of doing that. Our next steps with the training is the joint supervisory training, which years ago we did have, and that is so that our battalion chiefs, our station officers, the Metro, the WMATA police lieutenants and captains and whatnot, that they all have the opportunity to work together in that training environment, not just when something bad happens. Moving on to the ROC liaison, it's one of the things that I'm most proud of in this relationship over the past year that we've been able to put together. There was a lot of trepidation and, frankly, some resistance in the beginning that was just about the unknown. We have now gone from what was originally an 8-hour-a-day, 5-day-a-week posture to we're currently at 16 hours a day, 5 days a week, along with specialties like State of the Union, you know, inauguration, that'll be all those things. We'll make sure that the liaison is there. So we have, we as the chiefs have given the two folks that are there the flexibility to staff as they need to within the confines of the 16 hours. It started with Captain Konzel from Fairfax County Fire and Rescue, and then Prince George's County Fire EMS added Captain Key. In the past 2 months, we added, actually I guess 3 months ago, we added Captain Key. The two of them have been working closely with the ROC supervisors. Just yesterday, no, 2 days ago, I had the opportunity to be in our EOC as part of the snow situation, and Chief Pavlik called me and said, well, I'll save the details of what, but he said, we have a big fire response going on over at Morgan Metro, and we had, just as he was saying it in our EOC, it popped up on our screen. Just as it popped up on our screen, we're listening to our radio, I hear the ROC liaison, the fire department ROC liaison on the radio giving direction to the firefighting units about exactly where the incident was. It was a fire on the tracks. It wasn't a big deal, but it was trash fire on the tracks that required to shut down the rail. However, as the RAC liaison with the rail supervisor confirmed, third rail power was still established. It wasn't something firefighters could just go on the tracks and put out. It wasn't something the train operator could just go on the tracks and put out because third rail power was still there. But that coordination, and it happened that I believe the general manager was there with Chief Pavlik, so we got some firsthand opportunity to see that RAC liaison, and I happened to be on the other end of seeing it at the same time. So we know it works. It in the past 2 weeks, the report we just got presented 26 different things that the RAC liaison was involved with over the course of those 2 weeks that may or may not have involved the Fire and EMS Department, but that gave us visibility on everything from cracked rails to people locked in a bathroom to someone that slipped and needed, you know, had a broken ankle. All of those things are things that the fire department ultimately ends up dealing with. So having that person there with the visibility has been critical. Being able to talk on our radios across the region on the same radio platform, critical to our operation of safety and critical to getting the system back in operation quicker. So we have moved from 8 hours a day to 16 hours a day. Both the communications study and the fire chiefs have recommended it as a 24-hour-a-day posture. We are working with, you'll hear about our leadership meetings in a minute, we're working with WMATA on identifying ways to fund that and identifying ways to get to a 24-hour posture. We're just not there yet. Going on to the leadership meeting, after the Lafont Plaza incident, we reestablished, and I say reestablished because years ago we had meetings with the general manager, and it had just gone by the wayside over the years. We reestablished it, and we have met quarterly with the leadership team, and the you know, in those meetings, you see on the slide the four things that really are we have discussed so far: the radio outage display map, the RAC liaison position, the communication study that you're going to hear about in a minute, and our training. Have been critical to us continuing the partnership and continuing to grow that fabric of our public safety joint process. We have committed, and the general manager is committed, for quarterly meetings. We hold those meetings here, or if we're able to hold them at another facility, we'll do that. We've offered to both the leadership team here and at the RAC, to those supervisors, a partnership of is continuing this partnership, a partnership of their folks coming out and riding with our command officers, our battalion chiefs, or our deputies, so that they get the opportunity to see some of what challenges us. We have seen now what challenges WMATA with respect to Fire and EMS, so we've asked them, and they've tentatively accepted the offer, to come out and ride with our battalion chiefs or on our fire trucks so that they get the opportunity to see that. I think it's going to be important to continuing to grow this relationship. So we have committed to the quarterly meetings. Metro's committed to that. I would, one caution I would give to the board, to the team, is that I would resist the organizational culture that will likely arise that says we don't need a fire department person in the rail operations center anymore, that we can do this better. And that's just organizational culture. It's not about WMATA. I would urge the organization to resist that urge, to resist that as we move forward. We think it's important that this relationship continue to build. This isn't about money. This is about safety. And if we can improve the safety of our firefighters and our EMS personnel, if we can improve the safety of your employees and ultimately of the ridership, then that's the right thing to do. And we think that we've done that already, and we think we'll continue to do that as we build this relationship. So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Freudberg for the underground communications study.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chairman Goldman, members of the committee. Happy to be back here again. Have, again, continuing progress on the communications side. Steve Sauter and I will be dividing up this presentation. You've seen some of this before, a little bit of a refresher. There was work going on regarding underground communication system preceding the January 12th, now 2015 event. But since that time, tremendous progress. This study really derived from requests from Senator Warner to look at the underground communication, particularly the public safety radio, the fire radio system, and the cell phone system, and some procedures. So if we go to slide 7, the purpose of the study was to comprehensively look at the WMATA underground communication systems, looking at effectiveness, interoperability with regional partners, and then to make recommendations. I want to just point out and emphasize that there has been a very active and still ongoing engaged oversight committee of technical experts, Mr. Souter, who has chaired our 911 committee, Chief Scott Boggs, who chairs our public safety communications subcommittee, police and fire behind us, also technical experts from the district in Prince George's County, partnered with Chief Pavlik, Deputy General Manager, Rob Troop. Marshall Epler has been just absolutely fantastic in supporting us, and then our staff, Lisa Reagan, Christina Gerard from COG. So it's been a very engaged effort with a consultant. We've got two types of recommendations. I'll give you the status. One is making the existing system work better until the new high-tech system is in place. And then there's some sense of priority, and you've heard some of that already. The 21 recommendations we've grouped now into four areas: public safety radio system replacement, really part of the larger radio system replacement project, the ROC liaison you've heard about, 911 cellular access, Mr. Souter will focus on, and then situational awareness. So go to the next slide. You see the groupings there.
Mr. Frogart, could you just explain the difference between the public station and the 911? We do have some new board members as well as the public.
The public safety radio system is the handheld radio system that the firefighters use, and then that system, in order to use that through the tunnels and through the underground communication system, there are what are called bidirectional amplifiers that repeat the signal throughout the tunnel system, and that's what the first responders, that's what Chief Bashore was referring to, that enable underground communication by the firefighters with a handheld 700 or 800 megahertz radio. There is also what WMATA uses every single day, that the police use, that all the communications to the trains use between the ROC, and that's called the Comprehensive Radio Communication System. That's really the most actively used system. The public safety radio is episodic depending on events. And then separately, there's a cell phone system. There's actually two in the tunnels. There's a legacy Verizon system that was done 20 or some years ago, and then there's a part of an upgraded system that used to be called the neutral host, that's the cell phone system. That whole system is subject to a major upgrade and a partnership between WMATA and the four carriers that serve the system. So there's a cell system and a handheld radio system and a WMATA handheld radio system. Hopefully that's sufficiently clear. If there's questions, I'm happy to elaborate or have the people that really know the answers to give you the details. So up here are the priorities. I'd say they're sort of 1A, 1A plus, 1A plus plus, et cetera. We're trying to do all these simultaneously, but in reality, this is kind of the way the committee has looked at them. And let's kind of go on and see where we are. So again, the public safety radio system replacement is the fire radio system. It is ultimately part of the larger replacement project for the entire underground WMATA radio system and the public safety radio system. On the ongoing side, there's training and exercises. Part of some of the training that Chief Bashore talked about involves testing the radio system during events. There is procurement and training on tactical BDAs. This is the bidirectional amplifiers in the tunnels do fail. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. We generally now know where any problems are, so the fire departments can bring in a backup system to enable continued communication should there be an event. An additional of those systems are being procured. And then there's, by the jurisdictions, as well as WMATA, both just handheld radio testing, calling somebody as you're riding in the system back in the 911 or the fire department communications point, or testing the signal level. It's going on constantly now, weekly or biweekly by the jurisdictions, and essentially almost every day by WMATA to get a status of is there an outage anywhere that then gets reported. And that has made a tremendous difference in improving the status of the system. This is all funded by UASI funds as well as WMATA, a lot of staff resources to enable that and some procurement. On the short term, the study recommended a number of things. Replacement of what are called the head-end BDAs, which is at the beginning of the stations, to replace those now to enable the communication from the public safety radio system to be more reliable into the tunnels. That is part of WMATA's funding. And then there is a number of maintenance activities I've talked about, and I will talk more about the radio outage display. Spare parts, I know, has been a challenge in a lot of ways for WMATA. Improving that system, which I know is ongoing, is part of the communication study to make sure that when you need to fix something, you have the part to replace it quickly. That's happening. And then documenting. Change management here is really referring to documentation of the changes being made to the system as it's being repaired. And then finally, on the long term, there is a huge investment as part of the WMATA CIP to replace both the public safety radio system and the comprehensive radio system, the WMATA system. It's a 3-, 4-, 5-year project. The exact timing of that is still being worked through. I know the general manager and everyone would love to accelerate that. WMATA will do the bulk of the work here and also on the phone system to hang the cables at the same time. And there's going to be redundancy between what's called ISSI, which is an inter-radio frequency subsystem interface, which is a fancy way of referring to a software-based interconnectivity system that enables radios from the jurisdictions to connect into the underground system. That's being tested now in the jurisdictions, but there's also a traditional direct connect system that will also be in place. The 800 megahertz capable bidirectional amplifiers will be there too, so that the jurisdictions can get into the system and reliably in the future. So go to the next slide. I want to just focus a little bit on the radio outage display map. This is something that WMATA took the lead to develop, probably coming up to, I guess, 10 months ago now, I would say, something of that order. There's been some refinements. Bottom line is that you have a map system that is available to the jurisdictions, available to the ROC, available to all the WMATA personnel to know what's going on with the radios and are there any problems in any stretch of the underground system. This has led to a ticket being issued if there is a problem and a much more rapid repair system and has definitely led to a much greater level of reliability of the underground radio system. And the next slide just shows a little image. You've seen various versions of this showing where there may be, this is just illustrative, where there was at one point an outage in the public safety system or the WMATA radio system. And these things are getting repaired. And on the right, you have some additional capability if you click on things to be able to drill down on tickets and status. So the next slide, we've really covered the ROC liaison. The only thing that I will add is that we are working with WMATA and the jurisdictions on the long-term funding plan for that. We have identified additional UASI money to cover the 16 hours through September 2016. So we're in pretty good shape there, and we will build on that. We're working with the general manager and the staff to really evaluate how things are working and then to develop the plan for how this can be funded over the long term, the way Chief Beshore mentioned. So at this point, I'd like to turn to Steve Souter, 911 director from Fairfax County, has chaired our 911 directors, who will talk about the cell phone side of the system, and then I'll come back and talk about situational awareness and we'll wrap up.
Good morning. Thank you, Stuart, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here again. As was mentioned earlier, WMATA has been blessed for the last 20 years to have a below-ground access to 911. It was initiated in the early 1990s, and it was the pride of Metro and the pride of the nation. It was the only Metro system in the United States that had such access. Unfortunately, over a period of time, for a variety of reasons, that access became less and less and less as ridership became more and more and more. It was a proprietary system provided by originally Bell Atlantic and now Verizon. And that's what we entered into the most recent phase of Metro activities, beginning, of course, with the event last January. The 911 Directors Committee are committed to two things. One, that everybody that rides Metro have the same protection that 911 provides them above ground that they have when they go below ground. We know that the system that's there today, the legacy system, if you will, has diminished in its quality and its reliability. We will have a meeting in early February arranged by Metro, thank you very much, with Verizon to talk about the legacy system. What can be done with a legacy system to maximize its effectiveness for the next 2, 3, or 4 years while the new system is being installed? That's a lot of train rides and a lot of people over a lot of days. And we do not feel at all comfortable in just throwing our hands up and saying, we'll wait for the new system to come along. Something has to be done to make the current system better, if you will. I looked at my calendar before I came to the table, and it was just about a year ago today that I got a phone call from Marshall, who was behind me. And he said that Rob Troop had asked him to give me a call. And we began to talk about the event of January 12th, what happened, what didn't happen, 911, et cetera, et cetera. And quite frankly, looking back to that meeting, it was a little bit cautious, as new relationships are. But here, a year later, the partnership, if you will, that Chief Brashears had spoken to between the 911 directors, the Fire Chiefs Committee, Metro Transit Police, the General Manager's Office, and all has really gotten traction, if you will. And I'm proud of that, and you should be proud of that, and we appreciate that. But we've got a lot of work to do. We've got to bring the existing system up to maximize its effectiveness as soon as we can, while at the same time recognizing that that system still does not harness the power of the smart devices that each one of us carry. And that's where the new system comes into play, both from a reliability standpoint, the kind of information that we can communicate by a cell phone call, video, text, still photographs, and you name it. So we have kind of parallel things going on here. Maintain the old, improve, and install the new, and to do that in the collaboration that I'm proud to have seen us achieve in the last 12-plus months. So I appreciate it very much, and I would welcome any questions that the board may have.
Please, if you could.
Go to slide 16, and then, or I guess on your number, a couple of ahead here. Next one, keep going at that. So we're going to talk about situational awareness now and wrap up. The ROC liaison and all of the stuff that went on earlier is really a huge part of situational awareness. So is what Mr. Sider talked about in terms of passenger situational awareness, but there's a number of other areas that the communication study did focus on, including certain amount of maintenance of existing equipment, which Chief Pavlik talked about, particularly on the camera side of things, the blue light system. Smoke detectors we'll turn to in a minute. In the short term, having access for the jurisdiction to CCTV cameras was a major recommendation. That is in development. There is a certain amount of access now, and I think that will be happening in the relatively near term. What is recommended that currently has not been funded is adding CCTV cameras to the tunnel system, and also adding an automated smoke detector system as well. And there's some new technology the Deputy General Manager suggested that might be an acoustic-based smoke detection system, and the first responders would be very happy to have this additional capability in the underground tunnels. It's not just a capital investment, however, to do it. It's also an ongoing maintenance situation that you would have to have access to these cameras as well as to the smoke detection system, though the acoustic system may be a lot easier to maintain. But that has been under active discussion, and there is a plan to do some pilot testing with some of the vendors where some of the work has already begun on the underground radio replacement system to try these things out and see how they would work to get some experience. So that's one area that would help situational awareness. And the other, which is noted a little bit already on the law enforcement side, is having the computer-aided dispatch, the CAD capability on the fire side. And if you go to the next slide, the Northern Virginia Emergency Response System, which is one of the sub-regional entities that has been set up since 9/11, actually predated 9/11 in certain respects, has UASI funding to do a study on feasibility of a CAD-to-CAD interface to facilitate communication of data between the first responders and 911 centers and WMATA. And it does have tremendous potential, and this study hopefully will yield the information needed to make a decision on proceeding with that kind of system. So wrapping up here, the work group, as I mentioned, is still in place. It's been meeting every month. Sometimes there's been additional communication directly with the WMATA staff as various pieces of this are implemented. There is implementation now of the replacement of the underground radio system. And again, as I mentioned, the acceleration of that is being investigated, and to the degree that can be accelerated, then all the legacy systems we've been talking about will be no longer needed. And finally, we're happy to come back on a quarterly basis and update you. And here to take any questions. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. Your report, as usual, is helpful and very informative. And I'm sure it is fodder for a number of questions from members of the committee. I'd like to start off by going back and asking Chief and Mr. Furberg about the ROCC liaison. And I believe I heard you state that the current 16-hour system, 13-hour personnel, is funded through the end of December 2016?
September
2016.
Yes. Yes.
All right, so the next question is, what are the prospects for funding it the 16-hour beyond September of 2016?
I won't talk about the prospects, but I'll tell you what the fire chiefs have discussed and then recognize that we're having an ongoing discussion with the general manager. Chief Bowers and I, who are the two chiefs responsible for the folks that are there currently, have committed that we're not going to pull the plug on these guys if the funding were to run out tomorrow or in September or in December. It's too important for us. However, we also recognize that all of us have fiscal constraints and restraints, and it's not an open book, open checkbook for either of us. So we're going to make sure that, from our position, that liaison stays there regardless of when the current funding runs out. And as we continue in our quarterly meetings, the general manager asked the group to put together some options of the way things would look, could look, in our last meeting. And the team is working to put that together so that at our next meeting, hopefully we can have a better picture of what WMATA might be willing to do and what the fire chiefs might be able to do. So we're not going to pull the plug even if funding were to run out today.
All right. So over the next few months, the board will be going through its FY17 budget deliberation. So in that context, could you give us the number of what is the annual cost of the current 16-hour liaison, and then what would be the add-on if we wanted to expand that for the full 24/7 that you've recommended?
Yeah, so there's multiple ways to answer that question. All right, and I'll just break it down as quick as I can for you. As an individual salary versus salary and fringe, and the fringe is different in Maryland, D.C., and the district, or Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, depending on how you look at it, the fringe rate. But as a salary, you're looking at a captain's salary that is typically going to be in the $100,000 to $120,000 maximum range on an annualized basis. So if you need four or five people to make that work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and you have to make the shift work, there has to be relief. You know, you add that up, and, you know, you're in the $1 million to $1.5 million range just for salary. If we have a discussion about fringe, it's anywhere from, depending on the jurisdiction, anywhere from 50% to 75% of a fringe rate. You know, so add the numbers up. You know, you're anywhere from $3.25 million to a $4 million investment, depending on when you add the fringe into it. So certainly I'll take $10 million if the board's willing to put $10 million into the program. But I know, again, I go back to the understanding there's fiscal restraints and constraints that we'll do the best we can working through it. Does that answer the question?
And what would be the add-on, the increment to go to 24/7?
Well, that would be the 24/7.
That would be the 20,
right.
The 1 to 1.5.
Yep.
1.5 million
just
salary would be the 24/7.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Other questions, members of the committee? Chair Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Souter. With respect to 911, we have the issue of making it work here. It's my understanding there are also national issues with respect to the transition from a landline phone system to a largely cell phone system. And I assume that's in your wheelhouse to be working on that?
That's true. Currently, there is a nationwide movement to move to the next generation of 911. That next generation will allow 911 centers to receive the kind of information that today's devices can transmit. We have urged at this table, and we will urge in our conversations with whoever is our point of contact once the new cellular system contract has been achieved, to be sure that we're really compatible and that what is planning to be installed will be capable of carrying this kind of information.
Right.
And in the National Capital Region, what that means also, and it's a separate thing that COG is working on, that, as I like to say, 5 years from now, the only thing about 911 as we've known it for the last 45 years that's going to be the same is the number. Everything else is going to be different. And in the National Capital Region, we are actively working collaboratively to provide the new network that will provide the new means of transport in place of the traditional Verizons of the world that do this across the country, so that our citizens will be able to operate within this next generation environment, whether they're above ground or below ground. But good point. Thank you.
Mr. Dormsen?
Chief, could you clarify your statement about the fringe cost being 75 to 100% of salary?
No, 50 to 75% depending on the region. In some of the union contracts, in Prince George's County as an example, some of them are as high as the 75%.
And that's for what position, a lieutenant?
In that case, that's all positions that are covered by that particular contract. So that would be a firefighter up to a captain, could be a 75% fringe. And, you know, obviously benefits and everything that goes along with it. Hmm. Not as high in most jurisdictions. I recognize that.
Yeah, you'd need to hire a union negotiator because... New York Fire Department is only 30 to 35%. So I don't know what's going on in New York. It's not going on down here.
Mr. Augustine.
Good morning, and thank you for the presentation. Are you all, and I know this because of having spent time with Chief, that you all see things differently than we do. And you see risks and you see issues that that even the operators are not going to see. Is that part of this partnership, identifying risks so that we can be more resilient to issues that may be coming up? And, you know, this is, I appreciate the need to respond to issues that have occurred. But what about those things that are coming down the line and how this process and making sure that through this process we're gaining some of the knowledge that you all have of the things that you see when you're spending time with our system?
Are you addressing that to us? Or, okay. Short answer, yes, and that's part of that discussion about the training program. As we've seen particular incidents, for us it's about learning the system, learning what ailments, if you will, exist that are going to impact us, and then impact the ridership, impact the safety teams here. So we have adjusted our training based on what we've seen and learned, and then that helps us build the resiliency you're talking about to be able not only to respond better, I think the resiliency from a systemic perspective, you're going to have to speak to the group here about whether those things help them. But from a training and response perspective, we absolutely are learning from what we see and building a better program for moving forward.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, that's exactly when I just met with the chief last, I guess it was Thursday, right before the storm hit, in our first meeting. And that's why I asked for, hey, give me some time to work with you so I can understand some of these issues. You know, what is that we're getting out of this? What makes the most sense to do it, both on training? What do we learn from it? What do they learn from it? And then to deal with this other issue of right now, how do we do this thing? As I think we all agree that this has been very productive and something that we want to continue. But now how do we do that and how does that all work out? That's what we'll come back to you with the reports on that.
Mr. Chairman, I would just also note that COG has a series of committees that WMATA participates in, the police chiefs, the fire chiefs, a number of their subcommittees, the communications, the passenger rail safety, all peer network, emergency managers, all peer networks, and now 911, that enable this risk assessment to be ongoing constantly, and then share best practices and approaches and develop policies. So it's really the partnership that's been strengthened in the last year can take advantage of that, those resources. And we will build whatever additional ones we need to do. And then there's the whole Homeland Security Program, which all of these folks are part of, and actively looking at, you know, the high-risk areas and what to do about them.
Thank you. Anybody else? I want to keep on schedule, but I do have a question for Mr. Sauter on the Verizon legacy system. I do see a value of trying to improve that as we go through the construction of the more permanent system. But the question is the Verizon system only available to Verizon subscribers?
That's my understanding, although I do believe they have some kind of a contractor arrangement with another one of the carriers, wherein that carrier's transmissions would travel over the Verizon network. But clearly one of the things that we would like to chat with them about, whether or not that arrangement can be expanded to the other two carriers so that the four big carriers, and we all know who they are, could perhaps communicate on that same single, admittedly legacy system, if you will, but to provide fundamental, at least 911 connectivity throughout.
Do you know if technologically that's feasible?
I don't know, but I would assume that if they were able to do it with one carrier, they may be able to do it with two others.
Right. And the final question is, if they were not able to do that, do you know what percent of subscribers in this area are Verizon subscribers as opposed to the other three? You know, what's the value of doing this? I'm trying to get at.
I don't know, but my answer would be predicated simply by what I read in the paper about Verizon's dominance in coverage. But whether that's applicable to this region the way it is to a broader region, I'm really not sure. Right. Yeah.
Mike,
thank
Verizon you. Manages the 911 system for a lot of people, and it does accept it.
It does accept others?
Yeah, it accepts other carriers.
And so improvement of the Verizon system could benefit all.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Other 911 systems.
That work. Thank you. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you. We will see you in 3 or 4 months in April and May when the snow is all gone, and we look forward to cherry blossoms on the trees around the mall. Thank you. I think the next part of the program is that we'll have a presentation from the Acting Chief Safety Officer, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, sir. So my presentation is actually in two parts. The first part, I want to address the 91 systems maintenance inspection corrective actions that were agreed upon with the FTA last fall, and give you a status update on those. And I'm very pleased to report that all of the deliverables that have been submitted to the FTA in connection with the FTA SMI are either on schedule or ahead of schedule, and that's all that WMATA can attest to, that we've met our submission deadlines. I want to stress that the WMATA cannot control the internal process, review process with the FTA, but we're working hand in hand. In fact, as soon as I leave here, I'm joining a call with the FTA for our monthly meeting on those corrective actions. And that process is working very well. There's great cooperation, including this month they have started with weekly inspections of our various locations, Alexandria Yard, West Falls Church, and getting good feedback, good dialogue with the FTA. To date, just to set this in perspective, there are 91 corrective actions. However, those, when you break them down, work out to 732 actionable items. And I'm pleased to report as of last Friday, and we've been doing weekly submissions with them, we have submitted 283 out of the 732 actionable items. And as I said, everything is on time or ahead of schedule with the FTA. So that's, I'm pleased to report that kind of progress. The next part of my presentation deals with the Safety Directive 16-2. And as you recall, last month we had just received that from the FTA a day or so before the Safety and Security Committee meeting in December. So the Directive 16-2 examines and categorizes the 217 tri-state oversight findings that we were previously aware of, splitting those into four groups, and I'll go into more detail on the next slide. Also, please keep in mind that a number of these, or actually a majority of these, have come from internal safety reviews that WMATA has done on our own internal incident investigations. So nothing was really necessarily new to us with this process. The findings are now being resolved, and we're going to actually add those to the discussions with the SMI corrective actions. Also pleased to report that WMATA submitted a 30-day response to 16-2 and gave our comments acknowledging that the 217 corrective actions and actually only asking for reconsideration with an alternative approach to two of those, which are red signal violations and ATC, automatic train control. And if you wish more detail, it's in the January 14th letter, but we're happy to go into that if you wish. So of those 217, as I mentioned, they're divided into four categories. The easiest one is the bottom of the slide, category four, where they've taken 22, they've taken a number of those caps and injected them into the SMI process already, so they're populated into 22 of the SMI caps. So there's really no further action. They'll be handled along with the existing process of the SMI. And let me jump to category one, which is essentially a duplicate of the tri-state oversight approved corrective actions. That's 102, so that's the lion's share. But we are required to do some resubmission on things that we had already submitted to the tri-state oversight just to complete the process, but no real discussions need to be had on those. I think those will go fine. The area of most discussion is in category two and category three. There's eight in category two and 21 in category three, so for a total of 29 corrective actions that will be handled similar to the SMI process with much greater detail with individual deliverables, and we're in discussions with them. So just to recap, the 217, because of this process, have been taken down to 153 FTA findings. 21, as I mentioned, were previously submitted to the TOC for closure. There's roughly 93 of the 217 that were self-generated, as I mentioned, from our own internal safety reviews and accident incident investigations. And then there are 120 of the 217 that are from the triennial audits that the Tri-State Oversight had done and other external sources. They're formally new to us, but we participated in that process, so there's really no new surprises. Lastly, in the absence of the Tri-State Oversight WMATA updates to the committee, We have committed to developing a new monthly status report that will contain, at a minimum, an update of each cap, new findings and recommendations, budget implications, per the board's request, the hazard analysis rating, which we have been doing for the Tri-State Oversight Report, and the FTA oversight administrative protocol and issues that are still being worked out. And we've committed to the general manager that we will post our own progress on these, all of these corrective actions on the WMATA website. So that's being developed and hope to have that rolled out in the very near future. This new process, this new monthly report will be submitted to the committee prior to the regular committee meetings each month. So you'll have that to see what our progress is and anything new that's come down the line. Listed on the slide also is the FTA website, and I just want to make one quick comment before I close, is that I think the sense that WMATA wants to have our own tracking mechanism is because we feel that the FTA site doesn't necessarily give the credit to the all the deliverables that we've done so far. It doesn't give WMATA a fair shake on the progress that we have made. And so I think, and I've had discussions with Sean Thompson of the FTA, that we intend to do this, and he applauds us for having our own tracking system that enhances what the FTA website has. So that concludes my comments. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Just to circle back on the 91 recommendations, I think what I heard you say is that when you go to the website, it shows that there were a number of actions deliverables due from WMATA in December and in January. And I think I heard you said that we've met the deadlines on all of those deliverables for
That's
December
right.
and January
or
so far.
Early, actually, early submissions, yes.
Early submissions. When you go to that website, sometimes it shows under it that they've received the submission, the action plan, but it's under review.
Right.
Have those reviews been completed? Do we know now if those plans have, and implementation actions have been accepted by the FTA?
They're still in discussions, but relatively few that we've received feedback on so far. So I think in most cases you'll see the listing as a yellow in progress on the FTA website. And they aren't going to they recognize that we've met our commitments, our due dates. While it's in review, I don't believe we're going to be penalized.
Thank you. Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Brown. Getting my head around some of these numbers is always a challenge. In looking at the categories 1 through 4, it seems to me they don't reflect any priority per se.
The priority is reflected in the hazard analysis
that
will be assigned to each
so
one of those.
The categories is something that FTA set up. Is that
it's
correct?
An administrative.
Yeah, and that adds to the confusion of all the categories, because when you think of category one, you think, okay, does that mean priority one?
No.
You know, you think along those lines. What I would do, it seems to me also that FTA is trying to establish a template for use around the country for their reporting system.
That's correct.
And obviously we had a very detailed reporting system before, so it appears that they're incorporating some of our items, but not all of our items. I certainly would like to see in the monthly status report some summary at the end or of what we've completed each month or
right.
in the sequence of completion.
Absolutely.
And also a definition of hazard analysis ratings.
Okay.
And so I think, you know, from a definitional point of view, it would be useful to for folks when they see this report what all that means. And maybe already in there, I just haven't looked at that detail. So certainly I would encourage you to continue. It's obviously, when you look at the actionable items, you mentioned 600, 700. Yet there's only certain caps that you're reporting, so you, obviously there's multiple actions under each cap.
That's correct.
And I think that needs to be clarified to some degree in some footnotes as well. So
absolutely.
Thank you for your report and good luck on sorting all this out from a reporting point of view.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Giancola. Chair Downing?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the report and for the work with FTA. I think it's going to be beneficial to all of us. As we look forward to the monthly report, I hope some of the features that we had before will be recognized there, and that sooner rather than later we collapse all of the caps into just a single inventory rather than where did they come from, right. How many were from the FTA, how many were from the TARC. They're all out there. They all need to be done. I will share the view of Mr. Giancola that some are more important than others, and that kind of analysis of what are the most serious ones that we can look at month by month and saying, are we getting the job done? Are these mountains of snow melting as we move forward? And if there is, our report and the FTA report, one of the things that always happens when two people are reporting on the same thing, they won't always agree, but I hope you will keep a close track on any discrepancies, as we used to have with the TARC. They would come in and say there were 300. We would say there were 200. We got to be sure that we both are talking the same language and not spending a lot of time on irrelevant disagreements, but really relevant progress on the things we have to do. But I hope we can see regularly that the number will be decreasing. We also know it will increase as accident investigations or safety audits go forward. But over the last 5 years, we have brought this down to a pretty stable and constantly improving number of outstanding caps. I hope we can continue to do the same.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Just to that point, so we will be having a consolidated list from the WMATA perspective, but the FTA has asked for the reporting. They want two separate buckets.
Do you have a date by which we'll have that consolidated report?
We have the template, and it's we just have to fill in a few blanks, and hopefully within the next 2 weeks. It's certainly before in time for the next committee.
So we should see one by our next meeting in February?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Absolutely. Any other questions for Mr. Brown? All right, we'll move on to, the storm drain.
Sure. Having some experience with safety oversight agencies, I just wondered, when the FTA takes an item under review, do we have a standard duration for how that review will be closed out? Are they giving us an estimate upon the submission of a closure request, or is this, it goes into the FTA black hole?
I wouldn't say necessarily the latter, but as you can well imagine, many of these things may take a verification process on the part of the FTA, and they may want to monitor for several months. There is nothing set in stone as far as the timetable that they will get back to us. So, and I think rightfully so, that the response would be situational depending upon the subject matter.
Are there any examples of their, the length of their delay causing operational or programmatic problems for this agency?
I can answer from the safety perspective, I would say no. I could also ask Mr. Troop to chime in. We're continuing business as usual. We're addressing their requests, but it is not causing us to stop or change direction until we receive feedback from them. We charge ahead.
Yeah, we proceed with any safety initiatives that we may have based on the we proceed with any safety initiatives that we have based upon the information that that we're doing. If the FTA was to come back and say, no, you need to do something differently. Obviously, if it was required action, we'd have to change direction on that. So I would say that there is some concern about the FTA responding quickly for us to be able to move forward in the correct direction. Based on that, physical characteristics come to mind. Reports on track circuiting, certain initiatives that they put forward that we need clarification on to be able to get to decision points very, very quickly on that. There is a concern that we work closely with them and that we do get to a decision point with them very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer the question? I think okay. So. But do they have, I assume they have consultants working for them?
That is correct.
Do they have adequate consulting support? Because I know some of their people and managers are actually not transit professionals, are coming from the aviation space. So do they have the know-how to provide the proper oversight from your guys' perspective?
Currently,
I was just going to say it's. I'm pleased to see that they are enrolling and taking the Transportation Safety Institute classes that they're requiring as part of MAP 21. So many of the folks,
They're taking the classes that they require of others.
Yes.
Well, that's good.
Yes. So that's encouraging.
Mm-hmm. And also, Mr. Dormjoe, what they're doing is what they have started to do is bar people from the Federal Railroad Administration. They have four people that they have temporarily assigned from the Federal Railroad Administration on that. So they are federal employees. Mm-hmm. They're not consultants working directly with them, Track and Structures, ATC, and two other groups on those.
And speaking of the training, how can the FTA have training on MAP 21 when they haven't completed the rulemaking?
So the Transportation Safety Institute, you know, has a curriculum that's been developed, teaching SMS, teaching rail safety. Many of these pieces are being incorporated. The specifics as far as MAP 21 and the rulemaking that hasn't been completed, they're forging ahead with what they believe the current direction is, and it's fluid. They may have to, you know, modify. Do another training later.
Any other questions?
Not for now.
Thank you very much. Moving right along, thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Roth, our last piece of reporting and information for today will be a report update from Mr. Roth on the decoupling incident on the Green Line from earlier this month. Mr. Roth.
Good morning, Mr. Goldman. Good morning to the board. Thank you for the opportunity. On January 6, 2016, at approximately 08:10, train number 501 experienced an unintended uncoupling while traveling inbound in approach to the Navy Yard station. Train number 501 consisted of six 3000 series rail cars, and the undesired uncoupling occurred between the fourth and fifth cars in the consist. Earlier that morning, train crews reported difficulty while making the initial couple and requested car maintenance support. Car maintenance crews responded and corrected the issue, which appeared to be an electrical coupler head cover, which was stuck and would not allow the electrical coupler heads to make adequate contact. The issue was corrected and a proper electrical train line or an electrical connection was achieved. The train departed Branch Avenue Yard and entered service with no reported issues. Based on monitoring data downloaded from the rail cars, and eyewitness accounts, all rail cars went into emergency braking immediately after the electrical coupler heads lost positive contact. The train operator followed proper procedures and observed the uncoupled trains while conducting a visual inspection. At approximately 08:36 hours, 26 minutes after the uncoupling event, the train was recoupled. At 08:40 hours, the train traveled to Navy Yard Station, unloaded all customers from the incident train, and proceeded with no incident to Greenbelt Yard. FTA and WMATA Safety immediately reported to Greenbelt Yard, and the investigation commenced. The investigation team consisted of WMATA Safety, Car Engineering, our independent car consultant or car engineering consultant, and the coupler head manufacturers. FTA carried out their oversight mission and witnessed the conduct of the investigation. During the course of the investigation, we learned that the rail cars responded as designed after the uncoupling, causing them to safely come to a stop with no reported injuries to personnel or damage to equipment. The electrical coupler heads were tested, along with all electrical circuitry, and no defects were noted. There was no observable damage to any components on either train or any part of the coupling assembly. And the incident was not caused by an inadvertent command to uncouple, as that command would need to come from one of the cars involved in the uncoupling event, either the fourth or the fifth car, and the vehicle monitoring data also demonstrated that that did not occur. During the course of the investigation, two anomalies were noted. A lower stiffness than required in one leaf spring that is purposed to close the mechanical hook to ensure adequate engagement of the coupler heads, and more water than is desired in the air lines, which deliver the required force to open the hooks, one uncoupling. So the coupler heads are like this. To uncouple them, it's a pneumatic force and a piston that causes them to open. And then when that piston, when the pneumatic force is relieved and is at zero PSIs and the hooks are just sitting there in equilibrium, there's a spring action that requires or that, you know, causes the coupler heads to get engaged. So the part that makes them open, there was water in that system, and it appeared that that may have caused, you know, some ice buildup, and perhaps the pneumatic system could not properly relieve itself and come to a full state of equilibrium. And the spring that causes them to close, per the manufacturer, is required to be between 38 and 44 pounds of stiffness or deliver and tension force. And the measurement we took demonstrated that it was 4 pounds lower than required at 32 pounds. As a point of reference, we perform approximately 126,000 couples per year. Per experience staff, we were recently made aware through an interview we conducted last week that there was a report of a mainline uncoupling that occurred approximately 22 years ago.
Based mainline on Metro?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Thank you.
Based on the investigation, WMATA is recommending that we implement two new procedures. The cars go through what's called an A, B, and C inspection, or a 30, 60, 90-day inspection. At the 60 and 90-day inspection, the spring force is tested. But to date, we've been using an industry standard go and no-go gauge. It's a rather quick exercise. You put it on there, you pull it. If it goes past a certain point, then it fails. So, in other words, it's not delivering the required stiffness. I think what we've shown here is that we need to implement a tool that gives us a specific numeric parameter so that we can show that it's either within the range or it's not within the range. The second procedure, we winterize all of our cars in October, which includes draining the airlines. I think what this event has shown is that we need to include this, draining the airlines, as part of our daily safety test, what we call a DST. So those are the two remedial actions that we are recommending to positively affect the two anomalies that have been noted during the course of this investigation.
Thank you.
Any questions? That concludes the investigation. Thank you, sir.
Any questions from members? Supporter?
What assurance do we have that these anomalies that you've identified don't exist in other rail cars?
Yes, ma'am. When identified, we have tested a lot of other cars for the same two anomalies, water in the airlines. So draining that, you know, is not a labor-intensive process. We have also broken down. In order to do the test on the spring, you have to break down the coupler head. We have done that on numerous cars and have not noted any defects of a similar nature. Yes, ma'am.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr.
Okay, thank you, sir.
That concludes the business of the Safety and Security Committee for today. Before I give up the gavel to someone, I'll ask the Chair Downey, what is the schedule for the rest of the day for the... Very good. Then I adjourn the meeting of the safety and security meeting for today, and I pass the gavel to...